This week on Your Western Context, surprising topics arise during the Alberta NDP convention. Victoria City Council cancels Canada Day celebration, and a third of Green MPs cross the floor to the Liberals. Also, Trudeau faces a complicated relationship with both the U.S. and China. This is Western Context, episode 223, recorded Friday, June 11th, 2021. This title is canceled. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. This week, Patrick and myself are back, as we are each and every weekend, and we have a whole collection of news to discuss this week, and the vast majority of it is news that managed to slip under the radar.
Yes, that is indeed the case, where a few very small topics managed to dominate the news cycle this week. A lot of the news that we're talking about this week did fly under the radar and didn't really receive the coverage from the mainstream media that they deserved.
That's right. And of course, this week was all dominated by the horrendous terrorist attack in London, Ontario. And we would ordinarily want to cover something like this, but what we have seen in the media this week, we're still waiting on a good deal of information to come forward on this, and it has been the dominant story of the week, and pretty much all angles have already been covered, so that leaves very few angles for us to go down here at Western Context. So as a result, we're going to focus on this week talking about the news stories that didn't get covered. But if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to cut through all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media, and in doing so, hopefully we'll put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And I invite you to follow along in our full show notes, which you can find at westerncontext.ca. And we're going to start off with our Alberta story this week, because this is a story that all Albertans need to take note of. And it harkens back to an era in 2015 when Albertans, the media, and the opposition parties did not do the vetting that they needed to do on the Notley NDP. Now, as I mentioned this week, we could be talking about many other stories, and there's a lot of good news stories actually out of Alberta this week, including a substantial push to diversify the economy with government investment into the hydrogen industry, citizen initiative legislation passing third reading in the legislature, allowing the people of Alberta to bring forward issues that the government might be ignoring, and this is a perfect time for that to come into place, and really should galvanize citizen organization within the province. But we'll have a look at that in our spring session recap once that's done. And also, Alberta has moved into the second stage of its Open for Summer plan, which the Premier has been saying more recently that this is the Open for Good plan. But as we said, most of these things that I just mentioned did dominate the discussion this week, but one thing that was not talked about was the Alberta NDP policy convention that was held last weekend. The NDP were, of course, elected in 2015 with a majority government because the conservative forces at the time split the right-leaning vote, and what followed was an NDP government not vetted by the media thoroughly enough during the campaign, leading to a government that enacted policies that a majority of the population, almost 60%, voted against. The media is repeating their same folly here as in 2015 in not paying close attention to what the NDP says. First, Rachel Notley at this convention received 98.2% support of the delegates in her leadership review, and this is a level of support that is unheard of, except in certain undemocratic countries. When a popular political leader goes to a convention, they typically receive somewhere in the realm of 80 to 90%. Secondly, Notley also announced plans last Friday that if elected in 2023, she and the NDP will move Alberta's electricity grid to net zero by 2035. And at the end of the day, this means higher costs for Albertans. This means that we either need to import more electricity from our neighbors, BC and the US, and Saskatchewan, and double down on wind and solar, or nuclear. But the NDP's record shows that despite their environmental leanings, they are not pro-nuclear. Importing electricity from BC, Saskatchewan, or the US means higher costs, as does moving to solar or wind, shifting away from clean-burning natural gas, which currently accounts for a majority of our electrical generation. All of these are options that the NDP would like to engage with, and they will only increase prices for consumers at the end of the day. So far, we're talking about what happened outside the convention, but coverage of what happened in terms of the resolutions that were voted on and passed were covered horribly by all media outlets from the mainstream media and right-leaning side of the media spectrum in Alberta, who claim to stand up for Alberta conservatives. To their credit, the independent left-wing outlets did report on the convention. The party passed resolutions including guaranteed sick leave pay, a promise to roll back the UCP's education curriculum, adopt universal child care with or without federal government support, which, when you read between the lines, means more money being spent, more taxpayer money being spent, and higher taxes for Albertans. The party also pledged to reinforce long-term care and remain part of the federal Canada Pension Plan. But the most eyebrow-raising commitment is one to enact race-based data collection. After the horrendous attack in London, Ontario, there have been calls to examine whether Canada is a racist country. We also had the very sad story last week about Indigenous children being found buried at the Kamloops Residential School. And last year, the focus on Black Lives Matter after the George Floyd shooting in the United States caused many to question what race relations were currently like here in Canada, despite in some cases it being an imported problem from the United States. Canada was founded as a country where everybody is welcome, and everybody is welcome to practice their own culture and aren't expected to adopt a single cultural identity, as is the case with America. While we must address the injustices of the past, we also need to make sure we don't proceed down the path of using race to drive wedges between the threads that make us special, the threads that make us Albertan and Canadian. Race-based data collection, as detailed in scholarly articles, aims to provide equitable outcomes rather than equal opportunities, and many see this as a policy to combat racism. But at the end of the day, race-based data collection, when campaigned on by the NDP and their allies, is nothing more than a wedge. Now, this sounds awfully familiar, because those who use race as wedges are often referred to by most as racists. This is what we have seen many times in the past in federal elections here in Canada, and what we saw in the 2020 and 2016 U.S. elections, the topic of race coming up, and those who campaigned on race were often said to be racist. The media won't report this, but the NDP has become the most racist political party in Alberta since the Social Credits eugenics program. The NDP are masquerading as an alternative to the UCP, but in reality are supporting racism. Outside of the convention, this garnered zero discussion whatsoever. And this is something you think that would make its way to the top of the discussion this week, but sadly it did not. As for what the Alberta government is doing, the Justice Minister, Casey Matthew, who also happens to be Canada's first Black Justice Minister and an immigrant from Nigeria, he's in charge of a full-scale review of policing in the province to ensure that we don't accidentally or inadvertently have racist policies that are being enacted and carried out by the police in this province. The NDP, with this resolution, is going in the opposite direction, seeking to use race as a wedge issue in the 2023 race. But you might think that this is all we have to talk about outside of the NDP convention this week. The most insidious part of their convention came from Rachel Notley's announcement video of why she's running again. In particular, with this, in the video, she said that action often starts with an injustice, and she's an activist at heart. And the injustice that spurred her to consider running again for premier in 2023 was one of the first things, in her own words, that Jason Kenney and his government acted on when forming government. And in her own words, that was the act of ripping away rights of LGBTQ kids in school. She called this very cruel But we need to go back and actually look at what happened here on this, because back on Western Context, episode 123, we talked about Bill 8, the Education Amendment Act. The bill changed the Education Act to allow principals to contact students if it is believed their child is in danger, or rather to allow principals to contact parents if their child is in danger. In particular, we also in the past have profiled a story where a student was suicidal, and in order to save that student, the parents had to be involved. If the legislation regarding gay-straight alliances had remained, the parents would not have known. There are zero protections for LGBTQ students being removed or stripped away, or have been stripped away by the UCP government. Parents are the sole source of responsibility when it comes to a child's education in the province, and they should have every right to know if their child is in danger. So how exactly does this work? Well, the Education Act says that a principal shall permit the establishment of the student organization. They need to designate a staff liaison, and if a liaison can't be found, then the board and minister must immediately be informed, and the minister will select a liaison. The students will select a name for their group, and the group is started. And this is all highlighted in the Alberta Education Act, which is the law of the land. So this says that the board and minister must be informed immediately if there is no willing liaison in the school. The students are also protected by existing freedom of information and privacy legislation in Alberta, and student involvement is protected by default as detailed on the GSA's fact sheet. In particular, it says that schools cannot disclose a student's membership in any inclusion group, as there are student privacy considerations that trump other legislation. In particular, the Freedom of Information Act and the Protection of Privacy Act are what give students this privacy. The fact sheet also says that legislation needs to balance protecting children and their privacy with the rights of the parent, so students get the supports they need. But under the legislation as it exists, disclosure of GSA membership would only be justified if the student is at risk of harm. As a result of this, you can see this directly from the Alberta government website and the Education Act, there were zero rights ripped away by the government when they arrived to power in the summer of 2019. Put simply, the NDP are running on a lie that will raise the eyebrows of every progressive and will continually garner media attention in the province. This lie, combined with a move towards racism, should have garnered at least some media coverage. But instead, all we got was this discussion on energy, which itself was also covered poorly. As a final note on this story, all of the past resolutions were posted to social media, but the exact policy text is absent from the NDP website. We'll, of course, return to this story if the full resolutions are released and more information is made available on this race-based data collection policy.
Yeah, it's amazing how just because it's a convention based on an opposition party that the media in the province of Alberta and consequently the rest of Canada don't really seem to notice it very much, and they don't really want to talk about it as much as they would if it was a governmental party, because this story really flew under the radar. And what they were talking about at the convention, if you just read past the few bullet points that most of the outlets talked about, you'd actually see what the real truth of the matter is that was going on at the NDP convention, and that they were raising all of these sorts of social issues that many people would be very surprised to see them go after. And I think that's something that could have garnered a lot more media attention, because if more people had known about this, then perhaps the 2015 election might have gone a different way had these sorts of policies that they were thinking of while they were in power would have been changed ever so slightly because of what the feedback they would be getting from the media coverage of their policies during the election campaign. And certainly right now it's still going uncovered in the media, and well, that's a huge disservice to Albertans.
And any which way you split this, this is taking cues from the Biden campaign of 2020, because his entire campaign was also based on a huge lie, a piece of fake news, what many colloquially refer to as the Fine People hoax, where a video circulated on social media and on CNN and most of the outlets where Trump claimed that the people at the at a Virginia gathering were very fine people on both sides. But at the end of the day, there was some very clear context that was omitted from that. And if Rachel Notley is going to be running on a similar platform of trying to run for a lie, we have to catch this very early on. And that's what these conventions do. They provide us an insight of what the political parties are going to do going forward. And, you know, this is something the media should pay attention to. Political conventions, by default, almost always have slots for observers. So the UCP probably had people there. The media could have had people there. People in the media on the left and the right could have been there as well and been talking about this. But instead, they've all been pushing their own agendas this week. And, you know, it just takes a couple minutes of Googling to either look at the Education Act or the Alberta government's GSA fact sheet, which is current as of June 2019. You look at this and you see exactly what was passed and what the actions were taken by the government and the protections that are in place and even the website on GSAs. You see that everything that was said about these rights being so-called ripped away is just absolutely fake and absurd. But on the other side, we need to be very careful and, you know, we need to admit that over the last number of years, racial tensions have become inflamed for a variety of factors, factors that were part of what the politicians have been up to and some external factors as well. And as a result of that, using race as a wedge issue, no matter what political party you are, should be taken very seriously. But that's something that hasn't been done this week. And, you know, you have to look back and see last time a political party did this in Alberta, you have to go back to the Social Credit Party with the Alberta Eugenics Program. And, you know, that's a very clear and apt comparison between the two in this case. So as to why that didn't raise any eyebrows, I don't know. It's up to the media on that fact, but we do have that here at Western Context. We're going to move on to our BC story right now, but before we do that, I'll just tell our listeners how you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to. You can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/westerncontext. For as little as $2 a month, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month at the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. We also have a Western Context insider tier that gives you an insight into our work and gives you pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. And when we reach $30 a month in contributions, we'll craft an exclusive monthly news article for the Patreon subscribers, expanding on topical stories of the month. And these articles will, of course, continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. If we reach $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. As I mentioned, next up, we're going to talk about some very suspected moves made by the Victoria City Council in relation to Canada Day, but I think we can start into that right now because it's something everybody should raise their eyebrow about.
Yes, Victoria City Council has made the news again, and this time, like many times before, they are going against the grain. Now, council has voted unanimously to cancel its scheduled Canada Day programming this year, following the discovery of hundreds of First Nations children's remains near the former Kamloops Indian Residential School, which we discussed on last week's episode. Now, originally, the city had planned virtual programming to mark the day due to COVID-19 pandemic gathering restrictions, which will still be in place on July 1st. Instead, the city said it will be producing something for broadcast later this summer featuring local artists and guided by local First Nations. Now, Victoria Mayor Lisa Helpe said that before the council's decision, she spoke with local Indigenous individuals who generally participate in Canada Day celebrations, who said that they didn't feel that they could do so this year. Help said, quote, "They didn't feel comfortable participating this year because basically they're grief-struck and reeling, as are many Indigenous people across the country. As First Nations mourn, and in light of the challenging moment we are in as a Canadian nation following the discovery, Council has decided to take the time to explore new possibilities instead of the previously planned virtual Canada Day broadcast." Now, she acknowledged the Lekwungen people, on whose territory the city of Victoria was built, and the importance of ensuring that the city's plans for July 1st reflected the needs of that community as well. Help said that residents can still acknowledge the day in their own way, but that the city wants to provide an opportunity for thoughtful reflection and examination of what it truly means to be Canadian. Now, Councillor Charlene Thornton-Joe, who has helped to organize Canada Day celebrations for the past 2 decades, has noted that July 1st celebrations of the city started as an opportunity for immigrants to show their pride in calling Canada home. Now, although the City of Victoria has cancelled its virtual celebration, others on Vancouver Island are going ahead in partnership with local First Nations. In Sydney, a virtual Canada Day is ready to go, working hand-in-hand with Indigenous communities, according to Brad Edgett, who is the Executive Director for the Mary Winspear Centre. Edgett said, quote, "We've been able to add First Nations component to the beginning of the performance to pay homage to what has happened, and thought it was important to continue with what we've done, but to include even more First Nations participation." Now, Idle No More, which is a group formed in 2012 to advocate for Indigenous rights, is encouraging people to disrupt Canada Day celebrations with protests. Events are planned in Vancouver, Edmonton, and Winnipeg. The group's website says, quote, "The recent discovery at the Kamloops Residential School has reminded us that Canada remains a country that has built its foundation on the erasure and genocide of Indigenous nations, including children. We refuse to sit idle while Canada's violent history is celebrated." This from Idle No More. Now, Ellis Ross, who is a Liberal MLA representing Skeena in northwestern BC and the former chief councillor of the Haisla Nation, has opposed calls to cancel July 1st celebrations. He said, quote, "Can you imagine how significant it would be for First Nations and non-First Nations to be together on this day? We need this as part of our collective healing." And British Columbia Prime Minister John Horgan apparently agrees with him and said that he does not support the call to cancel online celebrations on July 1st, saying that people were looking at that date to put COVID-19 behind them and start the summer. Horgan said in a news conference, quote, "When it comes to the issues with respect to rights and title, with respect to reconciliation, I think all British Columbians stand together to mourn the issues that have emerged from Kamloops. I know that on the 21st of June, which is National Indigenous Peoples Day, would be a more appropriate time for us to collectively focus on how we can redress the wrongs of the past and build a brighter future together." Now, so far as of recording, no other major cities in Canada have followed Victoria in outright cancelling planned Canada Day events. Now, it won't stop the media from asking if we should, with many certain outlets such as CBC, CTV, Global News, and many others across the country asking if Canada Day should be cancelled. Now, Canada, at the end of the day, is a nation with an imperfect history, like many others in the world. Canada Day could be used as a way to have a discussion about all the things that went into making the country as great as it is that we all live in, and to talk about the bad things in our history that we can improve upon for the future. To cancel it completely will disallow opportunities for those discussions and healing to happen. And after the terrible discovery that we've had last week, I think a lot of people are looking for some positive news.
Yeah, and you know, this is an opportunity in disguise, because it's quite clear from the story that the Victoria City Council sees this as an opportunity to virtue signal and, in effect, roll out the red carpet and show how far they can go to atone for these injustices. But the opportunity in disguise here with this is to, as many have said in the past, many a political leader has said in the past, this is an opportunity to make a Canada for everyone, not only the people who arrived here as immigrants recently or in the last 100 years, but also for people who have been here since the beginning. And I'm not just talking about the beginning since Confederation, but the beginning before that. This is a country that has been highlighted in the story, does have an imperfect past, as every country does. But to erase that and to forget that in an effort to effectively start fresh from what many want to be a post-national, for Canada to be a post-national state, is a disservice to everybody. When at the end of the day, when applied with proper history and context, the holiday around Canada Day can be used to inform and educate and, in effect, make a country that's better than it was yesterday.
Yes, exactly. And for Canadians to get involved in Canada Day, it can be an education tool for children to learn about what's happened in Canada. It can be a tool to get people out and enjoying the summer, which after the last year and a half, has a lot of people cooped up indoors, questioning their mental health and certainly their physical health as well. So this can be a way to get outside, get outdoors, and celebrate Canada Day with people that you're close with, and kind of celebrate a new a way to start fresh into the summertime in trying to move past all of the bad things that have happened in the last year and a half under the COVID-19 restrictions. However, in doing it this way, by canceling it completely, you've lost that opportunity for discussion, you've lost the opportunity for education, and you've also made it so that people are still feeling like they're under the pressure. And, well, I mean, at the end of the day, this is something that the Victoria Council has decided to do, and as we talked about before, the Victoria Council can only legislate for the municipality of the city of Victoria, and, well, that doesn't really reach that far across the island. But what it will do is get the media talking about it. And when the mainstream media is always asking questions about whether we should do a certain thing, I think that means that a lot of people will be thinking about it as well. And hopefully, just bringing up this topic will mean that Canadians can have this discussion and then celebrate Canada Day in whichever way they choose to. But in Victoria, it appears that the council has decided to go a particular direction, and, well, it will remain to be seen if others will follow that as well.
And this entire story highlights the importance of our national holidays that have been so impacted by the pandemic, and it's been a countdown as to when these will begin. Alberta is slated to begin in early July. I don't know if we'll hit that Canada Day marker, but nonetheless, this is something that should raise eyebrows across all of the country and is a perfect opportunity for anybody of any political stripe to have this discussion with, just as we did here on Western Context. But in the case of many, they won't. And, you know, one thing that is sorely needed in this country at this time is a political leader that will build on the unity of Canadians across the entire country. We don't have that currently, and that's something that's needed. And this could have been a jumping-off point for somebody to be that person. But nonetheless, unity is something that always comes up, and party unity in the political system is something that also always comes up as well. And we're going to be moving to the Atlantic coast now, in particular with Fredericton, New Brunswick, where we talk about the fact that Green MP Jenica Atwin has crossed the floor to join the Liberal Party. Now, the Green Party made news in the last election when it elected 3 MPs, although some of them had predicted a larger breakthrough, potentially up to a dozen Green MLAs, some were expecting. And 2 of the 3 MPs came from British Columbia, 1 from Fredericton, New Brunswick. And that's who we're talking about today, Jenica Atwin. Now, this week, she announced that she was going to be joining the Liberal Party, and this marks a period of continued questions for the Greens since the new leader, Annamie Paul, did not choose tactfully about where she should run in a by-election. Last fall, Paul decided to run in downtown Toronto, competing against the Liberals and NDP. She came in second in the Toronto Centre by-election to replace Bill Morneau at the tail end of 2020. Now, at the time, there was criticism from the Greens that the Liberals and NDP did not extend what has often been called leader's courtesy to the Greens by allowing Paul to enter the House of Commons in a relatively uncontested by-election. The party has also been seen to have a problem with anti-Semitism among its ranks, with that being one of the issues that Annamie Paul sought to tackle herself as leader, since she is also Jewish. And this raises questions for a party that aims to have a national focus. So let's unpack these problems one at a time, starting with the electability of the Greens. Now, Fredericton has been an electoral district that was held by the Progressive Conservatives from the start of the Diefenbaker era in 1957 to the end of the Progressive Conservatives in 1993. Since then, it has been held by the Liberals with the exception of 2008 to 2015, when the Conservative Party of Canada won the seat. In the 2019 race, the Greens beat out the Conservatives by 1,629 votes, and the Liberals came in third behind the Conservatives by about 1,500 votes, garnering 13,544 votes. This is a seat that will contest heavily in the next election. There will be a renewed focus on it with Erin O'Toole as leader and this recent floor crossing. Elizabeth May is running again in the next election, and Paul Manley will also likely be elected again in BC, leaving the Greens with at least two MPs. The question then becomes, with Jenica Atwin gone and Annamie Paul looking for a seat, will the Greens be able to get their leader into the House of Commons? Jenica Atwin herself said that she wanted to work, in her words, with a more supportive and collaborative environment, and there were too many distractions in the Green Party, hence why she chose the Liberals. But what was most curious is that she said there was recent party infighting over the conflict in Israel, which took her away from her constituents. But based on what the Liberals have said, these negotiations for her to cross the floor started before the Israeli conflict. But just in the last month, Atwin had also tweeted in support of Palestine, saying, quote, "I stand with Palestine. There are no two sides to this conflict, only human rights abuses and apartheid." Keep in mind that Israel is the freest democracy in the Middle East of those that exist, and it's the only country in the Middle East where those of Jewish descent, Muslim faith, and Christian faith can worship freely. The tweet in question was sent in response to a Twitter user asking the Green MPs to write to Annamie Paul to ask where they stand on the situation in Israel. Ms. Atwin also took issue with small modular reactor technology, saying at a SMR, Small Modular Reaction Roundtable, held by the Greens, that she felt the Memorandum of Understanding on Small Modular Reactors that was signed by Ontario, Saskatchewan, and New Brunswick should inform the public about the economic and environmental risks to nuclear energy and SMRs. But, as we have long detailed here on Western Context, the only way to reach the established climate targets is with nuclear, since wind and solar do not produce the amount of energy required for Canada. The Liberals come out ahead with this floor crossing. We already know that the party has the staunch support of environmentalists in the likes of Stephen Guilbeault, who managed to become Minister of Culture. And this should raise huge questions for the Liberals, as now they have someone in their ranks who adamantly opposes Israel and stands with the Palestinian organization supported by Hamas. Now, had this been a member of another party that had crossed the floor to join the Conservatives and, say, for example, was pro-abortion or had a questionable past around LGBTQ rights, we'd be seeing a national media spectacle over this floor crossing. This is similar, but on the other side of the political spectrum, and the media is all but quiet on this.
It's very remarkable how this story did not garner any attention, given how any time there has been floor crossings in the past, there has been a lot of tension surrounding it. And the many names throughout history that have come up, they've always sparked a discussion of whether there should be a by-election in the riding, if there should be another election with the person who crossed the floor running for election under their new banner. And we didn't see that this time. We saw pretty much a passing glance to it and saying, oh, it's as if it wasn't a big deal that a Green MP, one of their three MPs that they had crossed the floor to join the governing Liberals. And, you know, the questionable history that Jenica Atwin has had with her views on Israel, given that her former party leader was Jewish, well, it raises a lot of questions as well. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that could have been talked about by the media, but they just completely glossed over this this week, and it really didn't receive any attention at all.
Yeah, and, you know, this is another blow to Anna Mee Paul, the leader of the Green Party, who needs to get her wheels in motion and fast before the next election is called and ensure that she's able to get into the House of Commons. Because if you're the leader of the Green Party, a party that is largely established due to the beachhead it has out on the West Coast, but if you are a new leader and you can't get elected, then that becomes a problem and a question that needs to be addressed going forward. We didn't see any discussion on that. And just as a point of comparison here, the Alberta UCP has a policy that if anybody in the opposition from any other party wanted to cross the floor and join the UCP, they would first need to resign their seat, win a UCP nomination for that riding, and then run in a by-election. And this is something that most political parties on the conservative side have thought of, and very few have actually implemented, but it would be interesting to see what the results of that would be if this had happened in Fredericton. But nonetheless, this is a story that was missed, and you know, you have to wonder why it was missed. But of course, that was all overshadowed by the big gathering that took place in Cornwall, England, with the G7 meeting. Joe Biden, first trip abroad as president. Justin Trudeau was there, and that's what we're going to talk about next in our Firing Line segment.
Yes, exactly. Now, with U.S. President Joe Biden's election back in November of 2020, many Canadians were looking towards a less complicated relationship between Canada and the U.S. Now, relations between former President Donald Trump and Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau were tumultuous at best, and many times Trump got the upper hand in trade negotiations, so specifically around the USMCA agreement. Now, with the election of Joe Biden, many people probably thought that Biden would be much kinder towards Canadian interests than the supposed belligerent Trump was. Right? Well, wrong. On day one of Biden's administration, he signed a stack of executive orders, including one that canceled the permit given by Trump for Keystone XL, which was a pipeline that, if completed, would have carried 830,000 barrels of crude oil a day from Hardisty, Alberta, to Nebraska. It would then connect with the original Keystone that runs to U.S. refineries on the Gulf Coast. Now, Keystone XL would have provided a much-needed outlet for Albertan oil and boost revenues for Canada by a large margin, as well as a much-needed boost for Canadian oil prices. Now, previously, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney said that the government would work with TC Energy, which was the owner of the pipeline in part in Canada, to use all legal avenues available to protect its interest in the project. Now, on Wednesday, Kenney said that Alberta will continue to work with its U.S. partners to ensure that the province is equipped to meet U.S. energy demands, saying that, quote, "We remain disappointed and frustrated with the circumstances surrounding the Keystone XL project, including the cancellation of the presidential permit for the pipeline's border crossing." Now, Richard Masson, who is an executive fellow with the University of Calgary's School of Public Policy, says that the pipeline was viewed as an essential link between supply and market. He said, quote, "We end up in a situation now where those refineries are still looking to get our oil, and we have fewer ways to get it there. That can result in lower prices for Canadian oil, less investment, fewer jobs, less taxes, and less royalties." Now, the Alberta government agreed last year to invest about $1.5 billion as equity in the project, plus billions more in loan guarantees in order to get the pipeline moving. As a result, the Canadian leg of the project had been under construction for several months, with about 1,000 workers working on it in southeast Alberta. Now, with the cancellation, the final cost to Albertans for Keystone XL will be about $1.3 billion, as the provincial government and TC Energy officially announced the termination of the project on Wednesday. Now, at the same time, leaders of the G7 are gathering in England for talks that are certain to be dominated by just three topics: COVID-19, climate change, and China. But it's that last topic that could end up dominating the discussion. Now, there has been a chorus of Western establishment voices on both sides of the Atlantic warning of the threat posed by Chinese-style authoritarianism and describing this moment as a not-to-be-missed opportunity to unite against it. Now, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has proposed an expanded alliance of democratic nations. He already has a working title for the new alliance, the D10. The D is for democracy, and the 10 are the traditional group of seven nations, plus three governments that are attending the Cornish summit as guests: India, Australia, and South Korea. Now, those three countries have more in common than elective democracy, of course. They also have serious issues with China, which is why they are presumptive allies in a world that appears to be dividing once again into antagonistic blocks. Now, having already hosted a successful climate summit in April, U.S. President Joe Biden has more or less cleared the decks to deal with the two topics, COVID-19 and China, which have intersected in the last few weeks since the rise in acceptance of the theory that Wuhan's laboratory of virology leaked the coronavirus, which has since devastated the world, both economically and in health-wise. Now, former Canadian diplomat and China scholar Charles Burton said that Canada faces a choice. He said, quote, "There's a desire for there to be more concerted action by an alliance of nations, which are affected by China's behavior in the absence of any effective UN ability to respond, because China is a permanent member of the Security Council and therefore able to veto anything significant." Now, is Canada prepared to stand up for the Australians, who are subject to the same hostage diplomacy as we expect the Australians to stand up for our Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor? Are we prepared to actually engage in programming which will displease the Chinese government in concert with our allies? Or do we want to leave this to other powers and hope that if Canada stands relatively neutral, that we will be able to protect our market position in China? This from Charles Burton, who says that he wants a more confrontational Canadian approach, but he said that his expectations are low on that matter. Now, ahead of the G7 meeting, where Biden is expected to look for allies against China, he made the surprising choice to rescind former President Donald Trump's executive orders that sought to effectively ban the Chinese-owned video app TikTok, instead replacing it with a new guideline for assessing apps' potential risks to U.S. data. Now, Trump has signed a slew of executive orders last year aimed at forcing TikTok, WeChat, and other apps linked to China to shutter their U.S. operations, citing allegations that Americans' personal data could fall into the hands of government officials in Beijing. TikTok last year sued to block the actions, and the courtroom battle has since dragged into the Biden administration. So at the end of the day, the U.S. is sending mixed signals on China, and it's also sending mixed signals to Canada. Those who hope for a less complicated relationship and an easier path on dealing with the Chinese government's aggression in concert with the United States will be sorely disappointed.
This summit, or meeting rather, brings up a whole series of interesting questions. And, you know, the first one of those is the relationship between the Trudeau government and the Biden administration better. Of course, the people in cabinet are going to enjoy working with the Biden administration more because they're more closely politically aligned. But is it yielding better outcomes for Canada? Clearly not yet. In the case of Keystone XL and any number of cases, especially in relation to cross-border travel and the like due to the pandemic. And, you know, you have to ask, what does this mean for Canada at the end of the day? And the real answer is that, well, the Alberta government plans to sue the U.S. administration for shutting down the Keystone XL permit in order to try and recoup some of that money. The second thing is that if anybody's taken a look at recent oil prices recently, crude oil is going up, and there's a recent forecast that crude could potentially hit $80 per barrel, WTI, the American benchmark price, before the end of the year. And at that price, crude by rail economics become a lot more favorable to Alberta. So whether or not we have this pipeline, there's going to be more oil flowing to the U.S., except it's going to be going on trains. And we know how dangerous those can be at times. And, you know, you have to ask, would you rather have a pipeline carrying oil or would you rather have more trains carrying oil? And the answer is going to be more trains. But at the end of the day, you know, that TikTok question, that's something that also always comes up. It's not just a question of data. It's a question of if the Chinese Communist Party has access to these data centers and the TikTok algorithm, they can effectively control what becomes viral in the U.S. and North America and other countries as well. And then that perforates out to Instagram, Facebook, and wider culture. So it's a huge mechanism of control. So it's something that definitely should be taken seriously by all the administrations. And whether or not anything comes out of the D10, we'll just have to wait and see. But it's about time that we start having these discussions.
Yes, exactly. We've seen this coming for quite some time now, but it seems only just now that the various administrations around the Western democracies are actually going to be talking about it. And, well, whether they're actually going to make the right decisions on what they should do with the Chinese government are going to be remain to be seen as well, too, because we've seen very many missteps along the way. And, well, as we've seen, as we've said many times before, the Chinese government doesn't do things very quickly. They do things slowly to ensure that they have a victory, no matter whether it would take a decade, two decades, or even longer. All of their industrialization and all of their economic activities have led up to this moment where they can try and undermine the Western democracies by controlling their social media through apps like TikTok, which are gaining much wider acceptance than I think many people would have even seen at the very, very start of it. And I think this is something that is very dangerous for the war over control, and that's what this is control of economies. It's the control over resources, and in the end, it's control over the internet as well, which is a major resource that can't be discounted. And I think that's something that a lot of the media in Canada doesn't really talk about very much when they talk about Canadian relations with the United States, is especially with the relations with the new president, Joe Biden, in the sense that, well, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau and Biden should be much more closely aligned politically on many different things. But has that resulted in a better deal for Canada? Well, not really. We haven't really reached any more favorable trade relations. We haven't reached any bilateral agreements, and indeed the border between Canada and the United States is still closed due to COVID-19, and, well, it hasn't really done favors for Canada either. So at the end of the day, we'll have to see how this goes, and we'll have to see what the leaders decide to do at the G7 in regards to China and how that will affect Canadians.
Yeah, and there's multiple ways of approaching these problems. You know, you can approach them from a pure economic sense, you can approach them from a foreign policy sense, or you can take the view in some cases, as some people do, that justice and equity is how these problems should be approached. And, you know, I think that those all apply even to the G7, but that's actually a nice move into our word of the week right now.
Yeah, so our word of the week this week is equity, which is described as a belief that stems from the idea that we do not all start from the same place and must acknowledge and make adjustments to imbalances to overcome barriers arising from bias or systemic structures. Now, equity in a purely justice form is something that is touted by a lot of left-leaning activists and politicians as something that we should be planning on. But in doing so, they're ignoring a lot of different biases and systemic structures that undermine the starting place of many other different people. And oftentimes, people's definitions of what equity is are very much different depending on what side of the political spectrum you're on, and depending on whether you're talking about certain ideas. And as we all know, everybody has a different idea as to what is the correct solution for something. And many people that tout equity are not really accounting for all of those variables.
And this is why it is so important that in all of our stories, the Alberta story, the G7 story, even the Victoria Canada Day story, we have a look at everything that has been laid out, and with that, have a true understanding of what the people in these stories are talking about. And we can have that understanding. We can also have that understanding when it comes to the floor crossing and the way the Greens and the Liberals conduct their affairs with one another. Now, with that being said, that requires a perfectly balanced media to do, which we do not have. It also requires a media without bias, which we do not have. And that's why all these stories here made it into our podcast this week, despite there being many other big news items that we could have talked about. As we mentioned, the horrendous London attack, news out of Alberta, how Alberta's going to recoup the $1.3 billion from Keystone, and so on and so forth. We could have talked about any of those stories at length, but these four stories that we chose were the stories that the media did not cover, and that's precisely why this podcast exists. And if you want to read more about any of these, you can find them in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, and more. And of course, you can also follow us on social media, on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we post some of the stories we're looking at and the shows, of course, when they release on Sunday. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always be sure to look through all the stories that the media talk about and a lot that they don't talk about in covering the stories that fly under the radar and should be discussed much more, whether they're in TV, print, online. We will find them and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.